Hey, this is Jazz United. My name is Nate Chenin, editorial director at WBGO.
And this is Greg Bryant. I host Jazz After Hours on WBGO. And this is a podcast generally about issues in the music community and generally just what's on our minds. But first, we have to acknowledge we've been away for a while. It's been a bit of a hiatus. I've had fun kind of handling some WBGO things, but some life stuff. And I know back to school has been a thing for your family, Nate, right?
Oh, it has. Yes, mm-hmm. It has. So we had fall preview at WBGO, and
yeah.
We also had a fall fun drive celebrating mm-hmm. our jazzathon.
Mm-hmm.
Greg, you and I got to hang out in my backyard at one point, which was
thanks
beautiful.
For the invite, man. That was awesome. That was an awesome day out back. Really, the first time, to be honest, Nate, that I've had real human contact in like 3 months. So
yeah.
Kudos to you, man, for the invite. And that was a memorable hang day. And also, folks, Nate is our editorial director. He single-handedly muscled our fall preview. Yes, we all participated, many of our announcers. But, man, hats off to you, man, for a great preview. I learned about some albums that are in the pipeline. And, folks, I encourage you, go to WBGO.org. Our fall preview is there. There's some great new and wonderful recordings that are coming out in the weeks and months ahead.
Thank you for that, Greg. I appreciate it. And one of the albums that I think everyone got excited about is an archival find by the First Lady of Song, Miss Ella Fitzgerald.
Heaven, I'm in heaven. And my heart beats so that I can hardly speak. And I seem to find the happiness I seek. When we're out together, dancing cheek to cheek.
This is an album called The Lost Berlin Tapes. It's actually out mm-hmm. now.
Right.
It's already been released. So, you know, if you're listening to this, maybe you've already heard it. But Greg and I are excited to talk about Ella on today's podcast. And I think not just because of that album, but because of what she means to both of us, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. To me, you know, she means the win, the victory, the success, but with a heavy, heavy cost of sacrifice. Mm-hmm. You know, Ella was, you know, orphaned at age 15. You know, she was on the streets homeless for almost 2 years in Harlem. But somehow she managed to win the Apollo amateur contests. And to say that her career took off after that is an understatement. Opportunities began opening up for her. Even with all that she endured, you know, she went through the fire, but she was not consumed. And so her story to me is one of triumph over adversity, Nate.
When I formed my relationship with Ella, I had no idea about any of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the music does not betray those confidences.
That's true.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
There is a way in which Ella is just the, you know, the word that always comes to mind for me is ebullience, you know. She is so effervescent. There is so much joy and life and spirit in her singing. And, you know, I think it's all too easy to gloss over the difficulties she had because she made everything sound so swinging and so joyous.
And we hear that on this album that we're going to discuss a bit later, The Lost Berlin Tapes. When I hear it, I hear harvest time. Yeah, there's been a whole lot of planting. But this is joy. This is harvest time that we're hearing in our ears. And I'm so happy that the powers that be decided that it was time for us to hear this recording.
Well, let's hear a taste of a song from that concert, and then we'll get back to this recording. But I feel like it would be cruel for us not to share a little bit of that music now.
That's right.
So how about a bit of Mack the Knife?
Mm-hmm.
And this is, in a certain way, this is a sequel to an iconic performance.
Right.
Ella's version of Mack the Knife from 1960 in Berlin was one of the most famous jazz vocal performances ever.
Absolutely.
And here she is revisiting the song in the same city, but with quite a different feel and you know, and a different result. So Ella, Mack the Knife, 1962 in Berlin.
people here.
Awesome, okay. Nate. You got me awake now. Awesome. Awesome.
All credit to Ella.
Indeed. Indeed.
So, Greg, you are married to a wonderful singer. I was raised by a couple of singers.
Indeed.
And so neither of us is primarily a vocalist, but we both have lived with that, you know? So we know from singing.
Yes.
And I wonder, I know for me that was really crucial in my understanding of Ella Fitzgerald's greatness, you know, just being around singers and understanding what goes into that. Mm-hmm. Is that the case for you too?
It's been something I've been pondering over the last couple of days and talking to Dara Tucker, my wife, as you mentioned. You know, singers have to deal with a whole lot of yin and yang that's not even musical. How you stand. What standard of beauty do you subscribe to? How do you communicate with your band members? How do you banter? It's a whole lot of things that don't have anything to do with music that singers are judged by. And I think some of that is unfortunate. Another thing that I think that singers are really responsible for is the immediacy of the musical performance. If there is a singer there, they're on the front lines, basically, Nate. And I think one of the testaments of Ella's greatness is that, yes, she was a great improviser. She was an amazing one, but she also prepared. And I'll even offer a bit of a controversial stance.
Bring it.
That great Mack the Knife from 1960s Berlin concert, I'm not so sure if all of that was off the cuff. Mm-hmm. I've talked to Dara about this too. I do believe that there was a performance somewhere in some city, maybe on the same tour, that she forgot the words, but it became a bit of a routine, one that maybe her and her band members embraced. Mm-hmm. And for such a landmark performance recorded by, you know, her producer, Norman Granz, no less, I don't believe that she was at all half-cocked when she rendered Mack the Knife. And you hear the evolution of that first planned stumbly version, if I can call it that, to this new version, if you will, on the Lost Berlin tapes. You hear the evolution and you hear the precision of, this is Ella when she's, you know, kind of prepared, but this is Ella when she's done it, you know, night after night for 2 years now. And you hear greatness get greater.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a really astute point. And I do not think you're off base with it. And I feel like the ungenerous way to put it would be to say that it's a shtick. But I don't think that's how you feel. And I certainly don't feel that way.
Right.
But, you know, when she's sort of going off lyric and saying, you know, now we're making a wreck of Mack the Knife. I mean, that is almost too good to be purely spontaneous.
Right.
It sort of reminds me of, remember a few years ago, when Black Thought delivered this instantly legendary freestyle.
Yes.
I actually was in the room at the NPR Music 10th anniversary concert when he tested out some of those phrases and some of those lines in that freestyle. Now, that does not in any way diminish the incredible performance.
Yes, sir.
Because that's what people do. You sort of you get your building blocks, you test them out. You see what fits and how it fits, and you're constantly tinkering and refining. And I think that must have been true for Ella Fitzgerald. You know, she was a genius improviser, but she was also an incredibly strategic performer and a very self-aware performer.
Right. Absolutely, Nate. Absolutely. Agree with you 100%. And she knew how to pull on a wide variety of her repertoire, you know, her library. Another interesting choice that she made at this 1962 concert is a number by the name of Jersey Bounce. And I did not know that tune was written by Tiny Bradshaw. Tiny Bradshaw is actually the first major performance opportunity that Ella had. She had won the amateur contest and just a year later won another opportunity to perform as a guest with the Tiny Bradshaw Band. And again, it's the knowledge and the wisdom of a singer, not only to read an audience, but to read the entirety of their catalog to see, hey, let me reflect on something of the past because it's the right time to do it for this crowd tonight.
Downtown gave it some licks. Downtown added some tricks. Now folks everywhere, they know just where it came from. So if you don't feel so hot, go out to some Jersey spot. And whether you're hip or not, the Jersey bounce will make you swing. Boot it, doot it, boot it, doot it, hippie. Boot it, doot it.
That's Ella Fitzgerald on Jersey Bounce, super swinging in the pocket, updating an early 40s tune for 1962. And not only Ella deserving of the credit, but man, this band is a well-oiled machine. Paul Smith on piano, Wilfred Middlebrooks, the bassist, and replacing Gus Johnson in the band at this time is a cat that doesn't get enough shine, in my opinion. Stan Levy on drums, one of the original bebop cats. Man, he is the secret weapon, I think, on this recording for me.
Yeah, you've got to have a really swinging drummer to stand up to Ella.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who could pretty much swing anybody off the bandstand.
Yep.
You know,
yep.
You had to have your reinforcements in place.
Absolutely.
But yeah, she is in fine form on this recording. And I think it's worth talking about why this took so long to see the light of day.
Yeah.
I talked about this album with Ken Drucker, the vice president for jazz development at Verve Label Group.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Ken was part of the team that brought this discovery to light. And, you know, it was literally in an unopened box in Norman Granz's personal collection. So Norman Granz was Ella's longtime manager, and he also was the founder of Verve Records. And in fact, he founded Verve Records expressly for the purpose of spotlighting Ella Fitzgerald.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is all in the family here. But can you imagine, Greg, just like going through boxes of stuff and then picking up the cardboard, you know, Ampeg box or whatever it was? There was yellowed Scotch tape sealing the box.
Yeah.
Ella Fitzgerald, 1962, Berlin.
Oh, man. You know, there's a James Brown song. It wasn't a big hit, but the early 70s, it was called I'm a Greedy Man. Mm. And that's how I really feel when I learn about these Holy Grail tapes that have been unearthed in the recent past couple of years. This one in particular, and as you told that story, Nate, I'm just thinking in my mind, what else must exist? What else is in the vault? What else have we not heard from this, I'll say it again, harvest period of Ella Fitzgerald, where she's happy, she's working hard, she's enjoying being and becoming the world-renowned star that she obviously was destined to be. I'm just in awe.
Well, I can tell you, without getting specific, because I don't know the specifics, but Ken said there's more where this came from.
Oh my goodness.
So, you know, we have not seen the end of this. And in fact, even in just the last few years, we've had some great archival Ella. You know, this, the last time I was writing about Ella for WBGO, it was because of the release of Ella at Zardy's, which was, which is another just fantastic live recording. And this one, you know, was made several years earlier, just as she was about to make the Cole Porter Songbook album, you know?
Yeah.
But the live performance, you know, she's one of those people like Charlie Parker, you know, you really are getting the true Ella when you're getting her in front of an audience.
You know it. Yes.
She was a marvelous studio singer. That's not taking anything away from her incredible studio recordings. But there's just such a give and take and such a crackling energy. A mutual exchange, really, right?
Between Absolutely.
Her and an audience, especially an audience like this one. There's another recent drop that should interest anyone who loves jazz vocals and certainly anyone who loves Ella. This documentary film called Just One of Those Things. It's now available on all streaming services, I think. You can rent it digitally. And so I wanted to talk about that film as well, because there's a certain amount of, it just lends some added context that I think is really valuable.
One of the main ingredients was having the participation of Ray Brown Jr., her adoptive son, with Ray Brown. Dara and I, maybe almost 10 years ago, had performed on some of the same stages as Ray Brown Jr., but we never really met him. We'd perform to a lot of the same audiences, and we'd hear these stories about he's kind of mysterious, nice guy, but kind of mysterious. But to really hear his take on his upbringing and just, longing for a relationship with a mother that was there for him, but elusive. You know, the teenage years are really critical. I remember mine. You know, it was awesome to have parents that were accessible, that were there, that I could, you know, work things out with. But being, surrounded by those two artists, in particular, Ella Fitzgerald, the majority of his life, you know, he really needed a mother, and she wanted to be a mother, but she loved song and singing and performing so much that she made a choice. You know, she made a choice to continue her pace and her legacy, and it had a toll on that relationship, unfortunately. But it was good to hear his insight on Ella as a person, on their reconciliation, if you can call it that, towards the end of her life. And I really enjoyed hearing not just, you know, these are all the highs, these are all the highlights. Ella is amazing. We all know that. But what went into the life of this superstar, this magnificent human being? There was a lot of sacrifice. And in a lot of cases, the family bears the brunt of those costs.
Yeah, no, that's one of the top easily two or three takeaways from the film for me too. And some of it was because Ray Brown Jr. is such a fascinating interview subject. Every time he speaks in this film, it's something worth hearing. His perspective is so invaluable. But then, yeah, also that idea of sacrifice and how that sacrifice centers in the family unit, you know. Mm-hmm. During that passage in the film where we're talking about her home life, there's a really beautiful scoring decision where they chose to feature Ella singing the Burt Bacharach Hal David song, A House Is Not a Home. And I'm not sure if the version that they chose was from the album Sunshine of Your Love, but that's a notable recording. Ella featured it on this 1969 live album. And it's a more contemporary song than many people associate with her. You know, she's kind of the quintessential great American songbook interpreter. And Bacharach and David are, you know, they're from the next generation. But her version of it is beautiful, and the sentiment expressed in the song is very poignant, especially in the context of the film.
And a house is not a home when there's no one there to hold you tight, and no one there you can kiss goodnight. A room is still a room, even when there's nothing there. A room is not a house, and a house is not a home when the two of us are far apart and one of us has a broken heart.
You know, it's interesting. You can ask whether that is a narrative thread that you'd find in a documentary about a great male jazz artist? And mm-hmm. I think in many cases, the answer is no. Mm. But one exception that comes to mind, another recent film is, I'm sure you've seen this Jaco Pastorius documentary.
Man. Yes.
And that actually is one of the things that in the back of my mind, kind of mm-hmm. a little spark went off, because that was one of the big things in that film for me too, was mm-hmm. hearing from Jaco's kids.
Yes. You know,
this absolutely. Sense of a lost figure, the sense of someone they wish they could have known better. Yeah. And the circumstances are far less tragic in mm-hmm. the case of Ella.
Yeah.
But the fact that the family has an opportunity to speak and to bear witness, I think is it's a really nice turn in these documentaries. You know, it's yeah. because it tells us something beyond what you get in a Grammy Hall of Fame highlight reel or what have you.
That's right. Yeah.
But, you know, another thing. So earlier you referred to, you know, everything that Ella had to overcome. Mm-hmm. And that was also dealt with in a really thoughtful way, I think, in this mm-hmm. film. If you know anything about Ella, you know that she was on the streets before she won the amateur contest at the Apollo. Mm-hmm. That's part of the lore and the legend, but it goes a little bit deeper. And one thing that really stuck out to me was her time in that detention home mm-hmm. and how there was talk of abuse there, and they pull up her file. Mm-hmm. There was a disciplinary file on her, on the teenaged Ella Fitzgerald. Mm-hmm. And at one point they said that she was, quote, ungovernable. Mm. And you think about all of the associations with a word like that when you're yeah. talking about a young Black woman, mm-hmm. A kid really,
yeah.
Under this institutional control. You know, it's mm-hmm. really chilling.
Yeah.
And in that one word, I feel like you can infer so much about what she was up against.
On the streets of Harlem in 1930s post-depression, that particular part of the city is vibrant with the arts. So there's no reason for a young Ella Fitzgerald not to hear Fats Waller or even see him walking by. You know, there's an access there that is genuine to helping her not only just express herself, but think maybe there's a way out for me, you know, in this medium.
Yeah.
But also, you know, the resilience of the human spirit. You know, she had to make a choice. Talking to a wide variety of folks, you know, in my formative years, you know, not just the valued parents and community figures, but also the street hustlers. And, you know, you can learn from anyone. Mm-hmm. And one lesson that I learned, you know, from some folks that were, let's just say, above the law, this life has a time limit and you can decide to get away from it to prolong your life. So Ella made that choice. You know, she didn't want to be on the streets forever. You know, she chose art. She chose it because that was a way out for her. It wasn't only expression. You know, she saw light in it and she went toward it. And thank goodness she was rewarded for that choice.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I don't want to psychoanalyze or speculate too much about motive and intention, but I think mm-hmm. it is worth noting that in the way that she was saved by shining that light on stage, mm-hmm. it's not hard to understand why someone who had that experience at such a formative time would then never want to ease up on mm-hmm. the gas, you know,
right.
as a touring artist.
Right.
I was looking at Norman Granz's biography by Tad Hershorn. And mm-hmm. there's a point in there where he acknowledges that some people thought Grants was too controlling and that he drove her too hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the schedule was really unforgiving. And that was very much true of this period that's captured on this album, this 1962 album. I mean, Ken Drucker was looking at the ledgers and he told me that there were some days when she would perform twice in two different, you know, cities or two
that's
different
right.
countries in Europe, you know.
That's right.
So... But then there's a counterpoint. So apparently Ella would complain and say, "Oh, why am I working so much? This mm-hmm. is, you know." And so then Norman would give her, you know, a couple weeks off, mm-hmm. and then, you know, after the first week, she'd say, "What's going on? Are people not interested in me anymore? Why right. am I not working?"
Absolutely. You know? Yeah.
So there was really she was so driven.
Yeah.
And you know that's work ethic, but there mm-hmm. also may have been some sort of deep psychological thing driving her.
Good point.
To seek out those audiences mm-hmm. and to, you know, and to test herself on stage.
Of all the documentaries on our music that have been featured over the last, you know, 4 or 5 years, you know, where does this rank? I think it's one of the best. I really have enjoyed, you mentioned the Jocko one earlier, the Lee Morgan story. I called him Morgan, Chasing Train, the John Coltrane documentary. But I feel like the Ella Fitzgerald one is of the same ilk. It's awesome. They had so much archival footage. They had video as well as photographs. She was very well documented. And I really feel like not only the directors, but the subject matter herself, you know, as we talk about women's rights and women in the arts, this was the right time for a movie on a figure such as this. So I don't know how you feel about it, but this is definitely in my top five.
And then there's an actual revelation in the film that has to do with her outspokenness on racism and on social justice. Mm-hmm. And it's from the exact same time period as the Lost Berlin tapes. In 1963, just a year later, she did an interview with Fred Robbins, mm-hmm. Who was a New York radio host. And she, you know, so keep in mind, it's 1963, right? So
yes.
It's on everyone's mind what's happening with the civil rights movement. And she speaks out in a more direct way than I think we've ever heard her. And it's interesting to hear how she says it, because she's even a little guarded in the way she opens up. You know, she says, maybe I'm stepping out, but mm-hmm. I have to say it because it's in my heart.
Right.
It makes you feel so bad to think we can't go down through certain parts of the South and give a concert like we do overseas and have everybody just come to hear the music and enjoy the music because of the prejudice thing that's going on. So you have to imagine, like, she's thinking about those audiences in Berlin, you know, and elsewhere in Europe. And why can't she do that in Birmingham? Why
right.
can't she do that in South Carolina, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's really powerful. And I wondered, Greg, how that moment spoke to you and whether it sheds a different light on Ella as a public figure.
Interesting question, Nate. We do know that the NAACP recognized her formally during that period. We do know through this interview directly how she felt about things. I'll say this. The fact that, number one, the interview never aired originally, and then number two, that she was so guarded, spoke to me of a serious PR push for Ella Fitzgerald. She was the darling of Verve Records, of Norman Granz, of Jazz at the Philharmonic. Maybe they didn't want their lead star, if you will, speaking out about relations of race, you know, in the United States. But the fact that she felt comfortable enough in this interview to voice that is really telling. But I think that she knew that not only what she said had to be in a certain way, but that she could be censored later. And she was. So
yeah.
It's kind of unfortunate. On one hand, as much as I hear about Norman Granz and what he did do for race relations and the music business, particularly our business, you know, going into segregated cities that would allow them a play there, staying in whatever hotel they wanted, you know, or refusing to do the show if people didn't comply with, you know, proper treatment of all the cast. And then hearing this interview, you know, censored, it's kind of... I don't know what to think, Nate, to be honest. And I know that's not a safe place to be, you know, as, you know, a so-called authority in the music. But I think Norman Granz did a lot of good. But the fact that Ella would be somehow reticent to say fully what was on her mind suggests that she was coerced the other way. So,
yeah, there's a moment in the interview where she says, oh, I really ran my mouth. Is this going down south? Do you think they're going to break my records up when they hear it? This is unusual for me. But, you know, I think that the perplexedness that you feel about this is honest. And I feel the same way. I have a theory about it that I'm kind of formulating on the spot, but I think some of it has to do with the nature of her art and the impression that it made. You know, Billie Holiday came out early in her career with Strange Fruit, and it was not discordant with the nature of her art to confront and to lay bare and to express pain and cry for justice. You know, like it kind of makes sense with what we know and feel about Billie Holiday. And the same is true, or maybe truer, of Nina Simone.
Yes.
It's like it's not subtext. It's
right.
text.
Right.
You know, it's right mm-hmm. there on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And with Ella, I think her music doesn't sound like it carries that burden. You know, that's what mm-hmm. I said earlier. It's so joyous. It's so resilient. And it kind of reminds me of, you know, her duet partner, Louis Armstrong.
Yes.
Know? And what a huge deal it was when he spoke out
mm-hmm.
About Faubus and, you know, about the president, because here's this, the embodiment of happiness.
Yeah.
You know, Louis Armstrong always has a smile on his face, mm-hmm. you know? And mm-hmm. so for him to speak out, I think Ella, you know, as we've seen, I think Ella would have been raked over the coals even more mm-hmm. as a woman.
Right.
I think Lewis got some flack, but I think she would have got it even worse. That to me sort of explains it. And I think she was, you know, she modeled it in her life, and she pushed for equality and for,
absolutely.
And for justice.
She did the work.
But I think, yeah, I think her reputation suffered in later years because she wasn't Nina Simone or mm-hmm. Billie Holiday in that regard, you know. And I think mm-hmm. that's a little bit of an unfair read because we're not all called to serve in exactly the same way.
That's true. And unfortunately, you know, all three of the examples you mentioned, they all suffered. It was very mm-hmm. existential. Billie yeah. Holiday died of, you know, a broken heart, as well as, you know, some, you know, personal issues she was dealing with. You know, Nina Simone is in obscurity and is broke for years before she gets a career mm-hmm. resurgence. And, you know, Ella Fitzgerald is allowed to continue. But as you said, you know, people throw these rocks saying, Ella, you're not doing enough, when right. really she is doing the work. So,
yeah,
choose one and get the same result. It's a choiceless choice almost.
Mm, yeah. There's another quote from that Fred Robbins interview. And Greg, you have the better voice of the two of us. I'd love to hear you read it.
Oh, my goodness.
Because I feel like it actually feels deeply resonant. In, mm-hmm. in the current moment, mm-hmm. as we talk about division in this country.
Right.
So Ella was talking about in the thick of the civil rights movement, and in this time when opinions were beginning to change, she reflects on like what that battle entails.
Mm-hmm.
So I would love to hear you read what she said about it.
Sure. She says, the diehards, they're just going to die hard. They're not going to give in. You've got to try and convince the younger ones. They're the ones who've got to make the future, and those are the ones we've got to worry about, not those diehards.
Yeah. I mean, that to me, it says so much about her astuteness,
mm-hmm.
you know, about society. You know, I mean, this a version of that same advice is being given in political circles right now.
Yes. Yeah.
So, mm-hmm. so to characterize Ella as sort of blissfully ignorant of the situation or floating above the fray in some way, like
right.
I think this interview, you know, and this isn't the only thing that mm-hmm. gives the lie to that reading, but to me it's the most powerful single document that we have on mm-hmm. that subject, and I think it's dealt with in a really smart way in this movie.
Yes it is.
So we've been talking about things both heavy and light, and I feel like maybe as we kind of approach the finish line, I think maybe we should toss it back to Berlin.
Sure.
And end with the church,
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
there's a really fantastic moment in this concert.
Yeah.
And Greg, you singled it out. It's definitely something that jumped out to me the first time I heard it.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't you set the scene?
There's a cut on this that Ella covers, Hallelujah. I Love Him So. That's a Ray Charles composition that is really a part of the birth of what we now know as soul music. As you mentioned, Nate, you know, joining the Black church with this new evolving music called rhythm and blues. You know, Ella was not averse to covering the material of the day. And what really struck me is not only her rendition, but how ready the Berlin audience was for this rendering and this tune. They had gotten the soul message even already, you know, that early in its history. It was so good to them and to Ella, she had to come back and reprise it and do some more of it. You know, they just couldn't get away with a 3-minute version. It had to come back for some more. And I think the band really takes this tune and they do it their way, but it's still effective, it's grooving, it's just like the best ear food. Hallelujah, I Love Him So.
Before I can count from 1 to 4, I hear a knock, 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 knock on my door. In the evening when the sun goes. Rachel say? He say what I say, yeah. I say what I say. Don't you come back, hit the road, Jack. And don't you come back no more, no more, no more, no more.
You know, this song had been released, I guess, about, what, 6 years earlier?
That's right.
And Ray Charles was, he was kind of at his apex or approaching it in 1962. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of a, it's sort of a great game, recognized game mm-hmm. moment mm-hmm. from across the ocean. Who knows? Maybe some of those people in Berlin had actually heard Ray Charles perform the same song on one of his tours. Well, so any closing thoughts on Ella as we wind down Jazz United?
Man, just Verve, Impulse, if you're listening, more, please. I mean, we need this music right now. That's what I'll say. I'm grateful for this. And if you've got any more, let us know about it.
Trick or treat, Halloween. It's right around the corner. Thank you for being with us. Greg, thank you so much. And, you know, I just want to say, if you go to WBGO.org, go to our show page, we will include links to all of the music we mentioned in this episode. We'll also include a video for one of the songs from the Lost Berlin tapes that was animated by one of Ella's many acolytes.
Yes, yes.
One and only Cecile McLaurin-Salvant.
Yeah.
We didn't mention her earlier, but you know, she is one of thousands of jazz vocalists who have learned untold number of things from Ella's example.
Thanks, Nate. It's always a blast. Folks, this is Jazz United from WBGO. Yours truly, Greg Bryant, with Nate Chenin. Our producer is Carolyn Bednarski. Our senior producer is Simon Rentner. And our theme music is United, written by Newark's own Wayne Shorter, performed by Newark's own trumpeter Woody Shaw. Thanks for listening. We'll see you again very soon.